Today's show is brought to you by Hearst Ranch Grass-Fed Beef, available on the internet at HearstRanch.com.
Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Vice President of the James Beard Foundation. And every Wednesday we have a conversation about my favorite topic, or one of my favorite topics, that is taste. The other one would be food, so they're kind of related. I only have two favorite topics, as everyone who knows me will know. And one of my favorite people to talk about those topics with is Ed Baer, the publisher and editor, creator, founder, bottle washer of the Amazing Art of Eating quarterly magazine. Welcome, Ed.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
We're glad to have you back here in Bushwick, Brooklyn. We are in the midst of what we call award season around here. I just came back from London last week with the World's 50 Best Restaurant Awards, which I have a part in helping to administrate. And we're in the midst. We've just finished the James Beard Foundation Awards, which is a very busy and much anticipated time. And at a few weeks ago, we were talking in front of some people at the Beard House at our Beard on Book series about cooking to win, let's say, or the taste of winning, about wines and competition and food shows. And since we're in the, where people are basking, those who won are basking in their glory, and those who didn't are crying or weeping, I thought maybe we could carry on that conversation on air for people listening at home.
Sure. It's a little bit speculative, and I don't want to deflate any winners, but it was a thought that I extrapolated from wine. And it's been observed by various people that if you have a flight of 100 bottles of wine, as some professionals sometimes face, or occasionally even more, there are those who think that's too many. But the wine that wins in a long series of wines in a tasting is not necessarily the best wine. It's the wine that stands out. It may be the wine that has a little sweetness to provide relief from all the acidity. It may have the most pumped up flavors. Something about it may have higher alcohol to carry those flavors. Something about it stands out. And it wins. Right. And yet, for instance, you'll be sitting at a dinner with a winemaker, and he'll have that prize-winning wine, which might be that pumped-up wine that would win in a tasting situation. And he's eating his meal, and he's got several glasses there. Mm-hmm. And the glass he's draining is not that concentrated, amped up, 99. High alcohol, 99-point wine. It's one of the lesser wines down the line of his range. So I'm thinking, you know, you're in a restaurant, and this is all part of this larger thing about current food, which when it works makes impeccable sense, and when it doesn't work just seems like chaos. And since what I do is write and edit, I'm keenly aware that when you're writing a review of one of these very contemporary food kinds of restaurants, I don't know whether to call them new American, international food, right, whether they're the successors to the so old that it's now nearly forgotten, but international hotel cooking, which was the debased descendant of Escoffier. Am I going too far?
No, but considering you were just recently staying at the Wyeth Hotel, and that they're cooking in Brooklyn, that all of that is so radically old, it's new and crazy.
Yeah, there's this, I mean, there are multiple trends, yes, but just I'll finish that thought, because it leads back to cooking to win. When a restaurant reviewer tries to describe a dish that succeeds, that's composed of multiple provocative tastes, things that weren't known to go together in the past, people hadn't thought of, or they come from new cuisines, ingredients that weren't available, that are now juxtaposed. You try to describe one of those dishes that works, that makes a great restaurant, shows the talent of the chef. And you describe one that's chaotic and doesn't work, and shows the chef's either lack of talent or lack of success on that day. You cannot tell from the descriptions which is the dish that succeeds and which is the dish that doesn't.
Right.
So that's kind of background for my thoughts. So and this is the kind of cooking, I think, that is in competitions, that is getting recognized, that mm-hmm. people kind of seek, because as a diner it can be very satisfying. You know, I always complain, oh, too many tastes, too many things on a plate. But people go out for an experience. So mm-hmm. there's there are various contradictions in terms of what creates high quality, what succeeds. You want fun. You want a lot of different taste. You don't want just one. Most people today don't seem to want just one thing. They don't just want a big bowl of chowder. They want multiple things. Of course, mm-hmm. a bowl of chowder can be a little complex and offer multiple tastes, so maybe it's a bad choice.
And be an interesting thing in the midst of all of this other thing going on. However,
Okay. So nowadays, what you get is the bowl. The chowder is just one component of the first course seafood, vegetable, fruit extravaganza with the exotic vinegar. All this to say that when you're in a chef competition and you have, let us say, I guess I'm thinking of Top Chef or something, but you have a panel of judges who really know their food, mm-hmm. and some of whom are chefs, people who really cook, is the dish, and they're just tasting. It's back to the wine. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got all these bottles lined up, but you're only tasting a sip, and there is a cumulative effect. Well, you're tasting a series of dishes, but you're not
enjoying a meal.
You're not enjoying a meal. You're not having a bowl full. You're not having a plate full. You're having a taste. Yes, you're probably carefully assembling your little forkful, mm-hmm. possibly a big forkful, but a forkful of all the elements. You're trying to replicate the intention of the chef who cooked the dish in your one forkful, but that's a completely different experience from eating a meal. So the question, I guess, is, and this is speculative, I'm not
right.
It seems to me that the dish that wins in a competition is not necessarily the dish that will make you the happiest when you sit down to dinner.
Interesting. There are so many things racing through my mind, through the minds of people listening at home, that I want to remind you guys, you can send us questions at info@heritageradionetwork.com, or if you're listening to the podcast on iTunes, you can tweet us a question at TasteMattersHRN, and we will be sure to answer, if not on air, on Twitter, which is like even better than air, maybe.
It's the air. it's
more substantive than
we
air.
We breathe it.
So one of the things, I'm remembering an experience I had recently judging a Cochon 555 event, which, for those of you who don't know, is this great heritage pork fest, pork palooza, that's traveling around the country right now, where five chefs are given five heritage pigs, and there are five wineries, and people try to blow everyone out off the ground with their pork palooza ideas, using every aspect of the pig, and I mean, it's so much fun because the chefs have so much fun just cooking their hearts out with everything they can possibly think of to do with a 300-pound hog. And one year that I judged was so interesting because one of the entries, who was Peter Hoffman at Savoy, did exactly sort of what you're talking about, and he decided to make one dish with every piece of that pig in it, and it was an Alsatian choucroute garni, and he did the charcuterie,
Peter.
And he did the, and I did, it was so brave and in some ways so radical amidst the other four competitors who served 75,000 different amazing, creative, wonderful things, and one of whom eventually won. It was actually someone who was on our show recently, and his name is totally left my mind, but he is the chef who we talked about Blood with, and his name is Brad Farmery, and he's a great, great cook. And he just did this amazing. It was like Cirque du Soleil versus, I don't know, a folk singer with a guitar. Mm-hmm. and as a judge, you asked to compare those two. You know, you can't even. What do you decide? I think I was the only one who thought, well, I just give him credit for making that one dish. It was so pleasant and showed such an interesting interpretation of the exercise before him that speaks to, I think, what we're talking about.
There's a kind of a purity.
Yes, yes. Let's talk about the meal, because some of what I hear is that perhaps the art of creating a meal or a menu may be changed, if it isn't being lost, may be changing because of how we are interacting and what we're doing in restaurants or even at home, how we entertain.
Well, completely. And I just want to hark back to one more thought. It's like, okay, in that forkful, you got this one taste on your plate, mm-hmm. in the competition, but on your plate as a diner, you get that taste. But there's this effort to provoke so much, maybe the best little combination. That's the thing, you only got one drop of the swirly sauce, and you know, mm-hmm. there's nothing. You're not necessarily always satisfying appetite that way. Not always. You're not as sensual as you, in a complete way. Mm-hmm. And certainly not in the way that food was sensual in the past, where you had this, sometimes at least, an opportunity to become satiated.
Hmm. So Laurent Gras said something to me during a meal at a restaurant. We were just talking about at Issa, where he said, "It's this certain types of cooking doesn't resonate with you emotionally, isn't satisfying emotionally. That you can't remember it. Mm-hmm. It might have been great. You may have remembered you tasted something you loved, but you can't remember what it was, and you actually probably couldn't even get it again if you went back to that same place because we've gone on to something else now."
Well, that's so true. Well, we're saying, in effect, dishes have become a little, I don't want to say deconstructed at all, unconstructed,
right.
You know, not put together in the way that dishes were understood to come together in the past. I don't say they're completely disconnected, but there's a large disconnection, mm-hmm. and also the structure of a meal, and I know you're keenly aware of it. We've had this conversation about the role of bread. Mm-hmm. This is just one small piece of it, but bread was the anchor of the meal. I mean, I've been in France with older French people sitting down at a table to eat in a restaurant, and the bread was bad, and they didn't care because you don't eat without bread. It's like eating, being in Asia and not having a meal without rice. You
right.
don't have a meal without bread. And it was certainly true, and I think it's still true if you're in France or Italy and probably Spain and in a certain number of other places, and you run out of bread and you ask for more politely in your French or Italian, so they think you know what you're doing, and they have this sense that they've an almost moral failing that they have let the bread run out at the table, the bread that goes with the food. And of course here, it's been a long time since people ate bread that way, if ever,
right.
not to get into history and so on. But what's come to happen here is, and certainly true in the UK, is bread is increasingly treated as an appetizer.
Mm.
And it comes at the beginning of the meal to kind of spoil your appetite, and then it goes away. And the traditional role of bread, which was to make other foods taste better, never has a chance to happen. You know, bread goes with cheese. Bread goes with certain things. It attenuates the flavor of hyper salty, concentrated, cured pork, you know, ham, whatever. Bread has its multiple roles. It makes sauce taste better, you know, when you're getting the last bit of sauce. There's certain things it just miraculously flatters, and that's especially white bread that's beautifully fermented. So there's that one element of the structure of a meal that has to do with components, but also the time element of where it occurs in a meal. But all these things, you know, you have we're still doing it, little amuse-bouche, little a first course, an appetizer kind of course, a main course, a dessert, but it gets fractured. You have different sizes of portions, people are sharing or they're not sharing. Some people at one end of the table can have a completely different experience from people at the other end of the table, depending. And of course, we're fooling around, as you and I were talking a little while ago, talking about the grilled celeriac mousse at Issa, which I guess they're known for, which I had the other night. And it's perhaps, in a way, a hopelessly savory component of something that you can't ever really fool anybody into thinking it's dessert, but it's fun, and I really enjoyed tasting it. But that's an example of things getting kind of, if not lost in a meal, certainly they're wandering around looking for a home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the concept of rules comes to mind, and the way that over time a food culture develops rules and then perhaps innovates against them or in reaction to them in some ways. And of course, when I think of food and I think of rules, I think of Japan, which is a place that is so aggressively codifies things, even when it's appropriate to not pay attention to rules, or in some way, you know, there's a place for that. Everything's got its own place.
There's a reason that French chefs go to Japan, that French pâtissiers go to Japan, that French bakers go to Japan, because they're understood.
Yes, indeed. They have a mentality that they get.
And when I say go, they open businesses.
Yes,
there.
For sure. And they're successful.
Yes.
They succeed.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, could this be a moment in evolution of our own food culture? You know, is this the point where it's publishing in the last century? It's the mayhem that comes before someone puts a stake in the ground and says, "Wait a second, you know, this is how we should be eating. This is who we are."
I mean, I think it's fascinating. I think it's good, but I also think it can be disappointing when you knew and appreciated a more structured way of eating that was very satisfying, and you can't find that so easily now. It's stimulating, it's frustrating, but I think probably things will settle down the way I think probably the the print versus digital world will eventually, publishing world will settle down and we'll find a way. It may have its good points and bad points, but I think it will settle down. On the other hand, one could say, in talking just about food, maybe it won't settle down. Maybe we're in this permanent state of flux where we keep getting this new stimulus from new places. To the, you know, the role of fashion keeps pushing, our celebration of fashion keeps pushing things so that people are always looking for something new. Mm-hmm. I mean, the role of fire in restaurants will retreat and be replaced by something else. I don't know what it would be, but, you know, you won't see stacks of wood in and behind every restaurant, maybe. Right. I don't know.
Well, we did already see chemistry tubes and science experiments, so who knows what's next.
I don't know. I could, you know, maybe I'm not being completely straightforward. I loved the old structure of a meal. I loved the tablecloth on the table, which was an indication of everything being in its place, and you kind of knew what was to come. And if you were in Italy, you know, in certain kinds of places, it was so structured that when the waiter came, they didn't tell you what was available. They said, "What do you want to eat?" Because they expected you to know what the foods of that place were, what was in season, what dishes would be likely to be had. And from their perspective, they understood the role of hospitality. They were there to please. Mm. So they said, "What would you like to eat?" And it was just wonderful. And then, of course, you didn't really know because I wouldn't necessarily know because I wasn't from the region and that attuned with the season. So, you know, you knew that as an outsider, your role was then to say, ci sono per primi, you know, uh-huh. What are the first courses? Uh-huh. And so on. And in those kinds of situations too, it was so built in. Well, the hospitality thing. So you wouldn't necessarily order the whole meal. You'd order something and then see what you felt like and see what you might want to eat next. And it was such a collaboration. Mm-hmm. So that's not a very French meal at all. That's a very particular Italian kind of thing. But it was so wonderfully structured.
Mm-hmm. We are going to come back and talk about hospitality after a break. You're listening to Taste Matters. I'm Mitchell Davis, and I'm talking to Ed Baer, publisher and editor of The Art of Eating.
Grass-fed beef, pasture-raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm talking to Ed Baer, the publisher and editor and one of my favorite writers at The Art of Eating.
Thank you.
A quarterly magazine he created more than 25 years ago. And we're talking about winning, sort of, in food and what that means, what winning tastes are and how they relate to the experience of eating. And I want to talk, since, again, we're in the midst of this award season and chefs have been decorated with James Beard Awards and global awards and all sorts of things. And I want to talk about where hospitality fits into that. We've created this world where chefs have become famous because, in some ways, because they're famous. You know, it's this self-fulfilling thing. You people start to pay attention to you. Now you find yourself on TV. You find yourself cooking in all these sorts of places. And it has so become about the chef.
Even and not the chefs are famous for being famous.
Yes, that's what I think.
And maybe, and you know, I think perhaps more about this than I, but the winning restaurants that get the places in the guidebooks, once you're there, it feeds on itself.
Absolutely. Looking at the list of the world's 50 best, you realize as being part of the process, which is a genuine and authentic process of 1,000 people voting for their favorite restaurants. But of course, it subscribes a group that becomes the conversation, and it's hard to change it. It's hard to
throw something really new into the mix.
Yes, unless you're a country that can spend a fortune to bring everybody there to say, wait a minute, talk about this. Even when you love a place and you vote for it and you put it on. And so it's become the equation. You mentioned this earlier in talking about some other traditional ways of creating a meal and the dynamic of a restaurant experience in Italy. And lately I've been noticing the change in the concept of hospitality where it's less, it seems to me these days, about the guest and more about something else, the brand, the chef, the experience that you are lucky to be having. And I don't mean to sound judgmental in this, but it's just that dynamic has changed.
I think everything can work. On the other hand, most of the time, a balance is really good. And when I say the extremes that I'm talking about are you go and you put yourself in the chef's hands, and the chef is driven largely by a conversation perhaps with himself, mm-hmm. and he's looking for something, and this is sort of art, either mm-hmm. in or out of quotation marks, according to your personal mm-hmm.
It was
views.
Actually, Rene Redzepi said to me the best thing about the attention he's gotten is now he can just cook what he wants to cook.
Yeah, this would be the prime example.
Yes.
You have the success, you can charge the prices, thus you can afford the labor, you can afford the materials, you can do what you want. You can afford the quantity of labor, not just the skills mm-hmm. and the number of people, but the hours of labor altogether to produce a more elaborate plate. And that's good, but it's not what you want most of the time. Mm-hmm. And the other alternative, and I think this is a huge problem and probably a much more common problem because most chefs aren't at the height of success and mm-hmm. fame and fortune and ability to achieve exactly what they dream of in their wildest fantasies. The alternative is the chef. The other extreme is the chef who perhaps sucks up too much mm-hmm. to the customer, wants too badly to please. And I would say that I've eaten some meals at restaurants owned by famous chefs, their flagship place that won't name names, where I just thought, this guy just wants so badly to please. He's got this whole plate figured out. He's put everything there. He's worried that if you don't like this, okay, then he'll give you this, and he knows you'll like that. And it's just, it lacks an edge. It lacks a force. Mm-hmm. There's a softness almost to that kind of cooking. And yet, what's really interesting to me, I think most of the time, what succeeds best is food that represents the tension between the desire to please the customer and the chef's desire to please himself. There's a kind of dialectic is too mm-hmm. strong a word, but too fancy a word. But there's a tension between mm-hmm. the two. I mean, and that makes you think harder and maybe do a tighter kind of work, tighter concepts, but tighter executions as mm-hmm. well.
Well, this comes back often when I'm talking about taste, and I think of the impact of market research or the idea of market research of taste, where you ask people what they want and then you give them what they want, and of course they like it and they even want more, versus asking what people want and then giving them something, having heard that, give them something else that they may not be able to imagine, but that
it's
aspirationally
they
might
want. It's the Steve Jobs Apple approach.
Yes.
It's like, make the product that people don't yet know they want.
Right, exactly. But in food, often you just describe the situation where you're just trying to figure out what they want. I mean, just as though on TV or in a competition, a chef is trying to cook for the judges to win the judges, or in a city even, you hear this come up a lot, that they're cooking for the critic because
sure.
they know what that critic's tastes are, and people won't even at certain points.
And in wine, of course, this was said very much of Robert Parker, people who would change their wines in order to make the wine closer to the palate of Robert Parker.
Right, which you can't blame anyone who needs to run a business and be successful, and those are good things.
No, yeah. it's not a moral failing, yeah. but it's a failure to be true to the grapes.
Right, to the grapes.
And, yes. But that's a little different from food.
Yeah, but it's an interesting. I mean, I feel like we're in an interesting moment where we are in some ways certain certain media have their auteurs that set a kind of conversation or parameters of where we are now, and there are trends in what are popular right now. Food is could be the movies of the 60s. I don't know, in terms of the cultural environment we're in. Mm-hmm. And yet in food, because it is so intimate, it's hard to be the auteur. It's hard to...
You mean for the chef?
For someone to balance the tensions you're discussing between pleasing the guests, they have to pay, they're going to eat it, they are going to...
And we haven't even begun to talk about service,
right,
which
right.
is a huge component of hospitality, and it's a huge component of your experience of a restaurant.
Yes.
And somebody I was sitting with last night was saying, for him... The service is the primary thing.
Yes.
It's not that he undervalues the taste component, the food, but as an experience, the service is the largest single component of whether he's happy or not when he leaves. And it's not for me. For me, it's food. But I can see that. And we've looked at in the casualization of life, the casualization of restaurants, that we've seen food become unconstructed. Service, it's a little different. Mm-hmm. Because all our service is copied from Europe to, in mm-hmm. restaurants, and you certainly agree, then it hadn't arrived. That level of service was only arriving at the same time restaurants were becoming mm-hmm. more and more casual, and food was becoming more unconstructed, and the restaurant experience was becoming unconstructed. So it's kind of working at cross purposes. And what's very interesting, and I just comment on it, is that you go into these funky restaurants, these urban rustic things with old barn board or fake old barn board, or I don't know, and they're cooking with fire, and the kitchen is open, and there's no tablecloth. But the service sometimes is so smart and so European, and you have these almost two cross currents of the ultra casual and of the very smart and knowing and professional, which has really descended from the kind of service that existed in luxury French restaurants 100 years ago. It's fascinating.
It is fascinating.
And it's part of hospitality, and it belongs. It's not formal and mindless. It's attentive and kind.
And it is also two ways. You alluded to this earlier, because the guest needs to know the rules as much as the restaurant needs to know the rules in order for the delivery to work, in order to be able to work around it. So in a rule-less place...
You have to know how to get what you want from a restaurant. And that means you have this, need to have some self-confidence, you need to have some experience, you have to be sensitive to what the restaurant can offer you. And you also, I think, have to be kind and friendly in on your side, and then people will give you more.
Right, indeed. And getting more is exactly what most people want in restaurants. That's
true.
A whole other topic. We talked to Mary Nessel about that and portion sizes. I'm I'm going to go back to Japan and this idea that you can that there people often feel like Japanese service is rude, and other people believe it's the most attentive in the world, and partly it's about the way it plays out in the dining room. Everyone sort of knows how they're supposed to behave, and all they want to do in Japan is figure out how to make you comfortable, and sometimes that makes you really uncomfortable because you don't know what you're supposed to do. You don't know
Sure.
where you're supposed to be.
Yeah.
And in these restaurants where the chefs are cooking for winning, for these bold flavors, for these whatever things, it's hard for me even to imagine what would work service-wise to complete that experience. I mean, unless it was that you didn't notice the service at all and you just sort of had a cafeteria-style restaurant, which people are trying also, the food truck, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, I think I like to notice the service. In the abstract, I like the sense that it's so natural. It shouldn't be oppressive, but I think you want to be aware of it up to a certain point. You want to feel cared for without it, and not quite so subtle that you're not even aware that you're being cared
right,
for.
Right. What do you think? I mean, you now you were here several months ago because you had just come out with a new book, a 25th anniversary book.
Yes.
And it is a collection of recipes of you could say, very traditional dishes from mostly Europe.
Yeah,
and
these are the anchors. These are the foundation. There are some unusual dishes, but many of them are not. They're mostly French and Italian. They're the Western foundation that we are leaving behind in part, but that reappears too. It usually is components of other more complicated dishes, mm-hmm. but they're the ones that if you had a big plateful, you would really be able to be satisfied.
And I was going to mention that we had the experience of enjoying a meal that Michael Anthony at Gramercy Tavern cooked based on
a wonderful meal.
Wonderful meal.
Beautiful, beautiful job, Michael Anthony.
Which sort of showed you the power of the meal, of the composition of a menu and the considered effort, the results of the considered effort.
He put a huge amount of thought into that. And of course, it showed.
And what strikes me is it was hard, he mentioned to us, for his staff to understand what he was doing because they don't really cook like that anymore. These people never cook like that.
Yeah, because they're young.
Right.
It's not contemporary restaurant cooking.
Right.
It's stripped down. You have to have a lot more confidence in the food in a way because there's nothing there to, I wouldn't say save it because these are dishes that don't need saving, and Gramercy Tavern right. cooks great food, so there's nothing needs saving. But there's something, I think, to a chef that's kind of reassuring that you have supports on the plate. You have other flavors, you have compliments, you have, I don't know, I want to say a little chutney, that's not a good example, but you have some complimentary vegetable something, some confit onion, some something. And when it's not there, I think it's as if the chef feels sending the food out, you know, undressed or
right.
something.
Where am I in this?
Right. So it's a different kind of thing. But I think it's the strength of food in the end. And I think we need to pay a little more attention to it. I don't say it's going to be a huge commercial hit on a wide scale anytime soon, but I think it's the thing that lies behind everything.
And on that note, on leaving our listeners digesting the concept of the strength of food and what brings us together, certainly, I'm going to thank you for being here.
Well, thank you so much. It was
so much
fun. It's
a great conversation. We will continue it, I am sure, in the future. Next week, we're welcoming Andrew Carmelini, a great American chef, and Gwen Hyman, his partner in life and his partner in writing. And we're going to talk about their book, American Flavors, which speaks to, in some ways, many of the same topics that we're talking about today and how you create how you take all of this in and serve something that is coherent and that provides a satisfying experience for the people who need to eat it and enjoy the restaurants. And so thank you. You're listening to Mitchell Davis on at Taste Matters. Sorry, I'm laughing. I'm my own name. I'm Mitchell Davis. This is Taste Matters every Wednesday at 11. You can download the podcast on iTunes, or you can follow us at Taste Matters HRN on Twitter.